Museum of African American Music in Nashville, down the street from the Ryman Auditorium, which I find a fascinating thing. This brand new museum is sort of like mushrooming up right in the heart of country music. I don't know any of the story or the history, but down the street from the Ryman, you know. So
Interesting.
it's as if it's to say that, we're part of it, you know. I mean, there's Tootsie's down the street, and there's this museum too, and so we can sort of share in the contributions. And I was thinking about that too, because I don't know if you follow much in country music, but since the Opry's moved from the Ryman, the commercial Opry, all of the great, big names, George Straits and Brad Paisley and all those, those are the sort of the newer ones, or the real old traditional commercial Nashville. That's all at Opryland, but the Ryman is a place where alt country and new country and Americana and blues and all those things happen. So it's strange to think of that stage, which used to be sort of like the mother church of country music, is now sort of the mother church of the I don't know, less commercial aspect, the hybrid, the sort of music behind the music, the shadowy soul of the real songwriters and real traditionalists, rather than an industry showcase.
Now, I'm sorry, I got a little lost because you're waxing philosophic about it. Now, you're talking about the Ryman, the original Ryman
The original Ryman Auditorium.
has become.
It's still a music venue, but it's not the
Gotcha.
home of the Grand Ole Opry.
Okay,
The
so
Grand
Grand
Ole
Ole
Opry is
Opry moved
to a
better space.
mall,
Oh,
a
wow.
mall hotel,
No, oh, I see. It called Opryland.
it's out of the Opryland.
Oh, gosh. So I just totally
You didn't know that.
blind.
That was a big transition. It's been like 3 or 4 decades now, And so,
Okay. Yeah, see, I come off, it's funny. I saw a Ken Burns thing, the whole Ken Burns country music thing, and was just properly blown away and really had never considered a lot of this until I saw that. So my education, in a way on country music, besides just a casual listener and appreciator of folk and songwriting, et cetera, was really just launched out of that. So that's how long I've been, in a way, paying attention to it. We're talking 2 years,
Isn't
right?
this ironic? I'm a white northerner, but I have a sense of a little bit of the history of country music and its relationship in a way that you don't. I was making an assumption that as a white southerner, you would have known sort of the history of Opry and the
Yeah,
Opry
no, zero.
land.
I was I the Ken Burns thing just blew my mind, actually. I really didn't know much at all about it. No, I mean, I'm a gosh, when I was growing up and we had New Orleans, obviously. So we had the New Orleans, the Pete Fountains and Al Hurt kind of, street jazzy, brassy jazz music was a thing. But then we just got fed, grew up in this, small town. We had disco, bluegrass and rock. And I was never really, my household, we didn't have, or nobody was hip, So I got my first record album was Led Zeppelin One. So my launch into music was hard rock, Led Zeppelin. We talked about that in a previous podcast.
We did. We did. And I wonder whether or not this is, you know, the assumptions that people make, and this is what this show's about a little bit.
Because
the assumption is that since you grew up in the South in the 60s and 70s, that you would be inured to country music. Since I grew up in the North and to some extent in California, that I would know like the Philadelphia sound and all that sort of stuff around black music. And well, yeah, I mean, it's a tangential understanding of it, but I grew up as much listening to the same things that you did, to some extent, rock and roll, and to singer songwriters, because I was coming out of that.
You certainly know more about country music than I do. I mean, than about music in a lot of other things, but particularly music. No, I mean your study of it is deep and wide. Mine's whatever it is, I can react to a thing, but my understanding of it doesn't.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter, you know.
I can talk about country music, but only, yeah, yeah. But I did read the thing. The New York Times is doing a kind of a raft of, they're just putting out a Beyonce article every 2 days.
Oh yeah,
in preparation for all this and talking about it. My take on it is it's a lot of tempest in a teapot. It may mean a lot more to critics and programmers than it does to the public. I'm always questioning the value of high dudgeon, is it really that important or really that earth shattering that we have to say it out loud that it is? I think you were right that our ignorance about Mickey Guyton and Recy Palmer is a lot more important than Beyonce's foray into country music, which is apparently what's currently driving the narrative.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of this. If you're going to make a metaphor, you can look at the surface of the pond and see all of the things that are reflected in it, and just make that the thing that you really focus on. So the surface of the pond is there's a country music. The business and radio and Beyonce and the sort of attention and then you go down underneath it, and then there's all of the people who are really connected to the music and under the surface, the fish swimming around, the seaweed waving and underneath there, all of that stuff.
That's a good analogy. I like
has been going on since the beginning of music and human existence and how people are moved deeply. But, you know, going back to the surface, I've looked at a lot of YouTube and people's not only reaction to Beyonce, but all the people doing the dance to Texas Hold'em and the whole sort of phenomena, and you know it's like the twist or like anything else over the whole history of American popular culture. There's a this sort of thing that people agree to use as a common touch points, which are not profound connections, but just, you know, we have a common language. It's like the words okay, which people understand all around the world, but a word that really has so much ambiguity and very little meaning. I'm okay. What does that mean?
Yeah.
So Texas Hold'em, this country, or we're all participating in this experience, but we're not really participating in the experience. We're just sharing a common meme.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I feel like I heard the song and I agreed. I mean, with anybody who says like, it's okay. It's, you know, as far as that goes, and it's Beyonce, it's her offering, and I'm sure there's more to come. I'm not sure where our starting off point is. I agree. It's more meme like than what does it bring for us? You and I in our.
I guess what it says is that we're trying to, you know, bring a deeper connection to see what brings us together and what pushes us apart, and whether or not race is a factor in that or not, or okay. Our perception of race is a factor in that or not. And what Texas Hold'em is doing is trying to say that, it's like I bought a Black Lives Matter t-shirt at Target. So I have a common experience because I got it at Target. And and it doesn't mean anything about the movement or anything. It just means that we have the same thing that says we're a part of a general group, a general tribe. Which may be important, but it may not be very deep or profound.
Yeah. So what are we to make, you and I, in this space about people's refusal to play it, for instance, or it not having, you know, 8 plays per hour as opposed to 3 plays per hour, or whatever the deep under the water, under the surface reality of it is when programmers are just trying to figure out. And then, you know, I read this article and you realize that there's programmers of programmers of programmers of programmers. It's like an endless mirror.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
There's, it used to be you could probably put them all in one room in Vegas every year for some conference. And now you have thousands of people who are literally curating playlists, right? Plus the AI, right. Which is doing more of it than we like to think.
The automation, you know? So that you're frozen. Yeah, are you there? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you're froze up too. I think our video's freezing up, but our audio seems to be staying. Okay.
So the automation aspect of it, the algorithm certainly is a part of it too. And I think Beyonce's organized her more recent releases, as all of the pop music has, around making sure that you engage the algorithm in a way that's profitable to you. But, we've been fortunate that we've had the opportunity to talk to people who have approached it from a deeper, more spiritual place. And the three interviews we've done so far, with Walter Parks and with Dom Flemings and with Chris Smither, in those three interviews, they talk about how the river of song has come to them from many channels and flows back out through them. That river of song is both tinged with the cultural experiences of the people who were there, and the personal experiences of the people who were there, and the universal human experience, and perhaps even the divine experience. I don't think that's a part of the calculation. At the same
time, well said.
At the same time, there's a need to have cultural touch points, and certainly Donald Trump is aware of that because he's got both a sneaker and a Bible. He's got a new Bible, which is
an American
themed Bible. Yeah, costs $60. I mean, anything for a buck, right? So that's the most surface way. Of course, the Bible, you don't have to pay anybody any royalties.
No.
All he has to pay for is the paper and the, you know, and I'm sure it's a cheap paperback that he's selling for $60. So,
Was it a rewritten one?
It's got
Trump on the cover,
flags and eagles.
The Trump base are dyed in the wool suckers, and you got to get as much out of them as you can. He's proving that he can pull lots of money out of, you know, people's hands.
Yeah. Well, but I say that to say that this is, you know, for me, a fascinating part of what we're doing in our conversations is not only talking about where cultures intersect, but on what level they intersect. Since there's all of that going on,
And how much of it is us trying to just understand it verbally and orally on a podcast and record it, two guys trying to suss it out? And how much of it is important to try to, you know, put out there, describe for people? How much do people care about the structure of this culture, the society? It always gets in these airy-fairy concepts in my head. It gets abstract pretty quickly, and I'm always hoping to keep it in the concrete.
Well, one way to think of it, I mean, there's a reason for it being airy fairy. You know, the philosopher David Hume, one of the things he sort of talked about was that that there is no such thing as a person and a time, but there are thousands of people in thousands of times, and that we switch and we vacillate different experiences as we meet different people, as we are presented with different challenges, as we have different states of mind. And yet at the same time, we yearn for something that's stable. So that's the concept of race, for instance. Black people are this and white people are that. And these people are good and these people are bad. And this situation is rewarding, or this situation is punitive, or this is, you know, and everything in my personal experience is situational. While it may not be as radical as every experience is a new experience, and every person is a new person constantly, I do feel that there's a balance. So when we talk about culture, pop culture has a tendency to focus on solid states in flux. And I'm wondering whether or not, for me, something more deep is recognizing the flux is always there, and then seeing what is the continuity. So the continuity may be that the suffering that Black people had in this culture contributes to a sense of not having dismissive experiences around music, but at the same time recognizing the fact that you're not always Black, you're not always thinking in that way, that you're also thinking like an American, and so you can be like Beyoncé and as an American say, I can do a novelty song, and I can do a song, or Lil Nas X, I can do a novelty song, that echoes the more profound experiences, but it just creates a pleasant feeling. Just yeah. makes you feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, you're describing the music. I'm sorry, I think I got off, lost the train of thought there. So run that by me again.
I'm saying that there's an intersectionality, right? That everybody's many things at the same mm-hmm. time, and that we choose what to be at any given moment, and the focus that we have. On pop culture, the focus that we have in a podcast where we reflect on pop culture is like making much out of something that's not much in order to have an understanding and that's marketable. That's what the internet is. That's what Trump's Bible is. That's what Texas Hold'em is, but maybe those things aren't really important. They're only important in that by recognizing the unimportance, we can turn our attention to what is real important. And what's really important is this moment that you and I are having right now. Ooh. Using that as a vessel to understand why we want to connect, where we want to connect. What aspect of our racial identities play in that or doesn't play in that, how important or unimportant all of that is.
Okay.
And I think that's the crux of what this podcast is about. And we're just using all of these other things as vehicles to address that.
Okay. Well said. I like it. And I agree. And so it is this kind of tentative searching, using other things as a way to figure our way forward towards some understanding, some mutual, not kumbaya, but an agreement.
And what do you think, Clark, is the impetus for this? Why you actually got the ball rolling in all of this. What is the deeper impetus?
I keep hearing in this world all this sturm and drang around racial difference, and so when Beyonce decides to do country music, it has all that. It's fraught, it's fraught with all this stuff. And I try to pick out what's the just marketing sensibility of it from her. And like you say, these people they're not Beyonce and her people, the hundreds of them that there are who make their living producing and creating her legend and her music and putting it all out there and getting all out there with this singular vision, are not fools. These are brilliant players in the field of music. And so I'm concerned that they're using perceived racial animus in the system one of the wheels of their carriage that shoots them into the, I don't know, I lost an analogy there, but you know what I mean? They use that as they need it to be. And so let me jump to something that I've always perceived, and this is in the world of Ebony Magazine or Jet Magazine or whatever, or any, or BET or for God's sake, Tyler Perry and all these very black businesses. And I always wondered how much of what they're doing, it requires difference. And what's the value of racial difference in our society? And for sure there's negative, but also positive aspects of it in a million different directions. So I guess when you're asking about why I'm interested in it, it's trying to tease apart some understanding of what does it mean in America, I guess, really, because it is an American problem, right? If you want to call it a problem, it's an American, I mean, I guess it's more than that, but
I think I hear where you're coming from, and I think it's important. I think there are two things that have to be separated out. One is that if we're talking about an American consensus, or where we're talking not about appropriation but appreciation, we're mm-hmm. talking about having an American shared space. And the problem that we have with that historically is that when we talk about an American shared space, it winds up being the white space, right? And the black and the black contribution is marginalized or ignored, mm-hmm. not immediately, but eventually over time it becomes mm-hmm. ignored, unless the black experience is championed and elucidated, illuminated, brought out so that it can't be ignored. And I've got two examples. One is Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, and voting rights, and his assumption that because things have gotten better because of the Voting Rights Act, that they no longer need to have the Voting Rights Act, rather than recognizing the fact that without the assiduous work that people are doing in order to make sure that there is a fair representation on the part of black people, that the status quo that he's championed and that we've arrived at wouldn't exist, and that if you take away those protections, things will revert back to where they were. So his assumption is that without the protections, society itself would be fair and benevolent, and the experience, the historical experience of black people in America, is that without those protections, the majority reverts to oppressive behaviors or resorts to behaviors that preserves their advantage in the society. And that only by having the perspective of someone who can not feel the experience being the predominant force in the decision making, do you have a way in which you can continue to protect the status quo of inequality? The second analogy that I think we could make is again the cultural one, that what Beyonce is attempting to do is say that within the commercial world of popular culture and popular music, that there is a way and a role, the historic minstrel role for African American performers, and that within the context of that, you can bifurcate, segregate culture, and limit the accomplishments to specific areas and have specific levels of success. In other words, the idea is that there's a competitive relationship between cultures rather than a collaborative relationship, and that her attempt is to say that rather than have separate spheres of influence, I will force collaboration, and I will force collaboration by doing what you do as well as you do it in such a way that you can have to acknowledge that we are all in this together. And certainly when it goes the other way around, here's the example, white rappers. When white rappers began to succeed, when Eminem made as much or more money than any black rapper, et cetera, then you had a situation where you began to build a common language and consensus, and the fact that ultimately some of these folks have become as much a part of the scene, the white rappers, and recognized as black rappers, and welcome into that world. So that's the sort of using pop culture. But both that still doesn't get down to the deep part, the really deep part, which is what we're trying to do, I think, in this podcast, which is not just to use it in terms of popular culture or some sort of a commercial consensus, but how we can actually come to some sort of community of souls, recognizing that it's not a post-racial world, but recognizing that that bringing what we all bring to the table, we can share and understanding.
That was really well said and nicely presented. And so the way I started to find a couple of places that I am interested in, one being the DNA of black-white relations in America. You know, from the alpha, what's the alpha? Let's get back to the beginnings of it and talk and see about it and investigate it and look into it. So the prevalence of minstrelsy as an art form in the 19th century that pretty much predominated throughout, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin was this play written and seen and rewritten and acted in over decades and decades, especially after the Civil War. Well, obviously after the Civil War, but it had differences in the North and differences in the South. I would love to look into all that and pull that apart. And so that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in going back as a historical. I'm telling myself, I'm saying this out loud to understand it for myself. There was one other thing that was more forward from that that you were just talking about. But, for black creativity in this society, what does that mean? Where, at what point can you ascribe it to the pressures of slavery, the pressures of racism and oppression, the reaction to it, and therefore the in a way what you want to call the ownership of it? So rap, you know, rap is comes from the pressures of living in urban American society, or is it about the black experience, the black soul, the black
So we're back to that pond metaphor again. I mean, of course, all of those things are true. We can trace, and it seems all of this is just a feeling, right? I mean, you can try and come up with data, you know, and pick specific examples and build your own little castle of sand, saying that this slave master and his relationship with this family exemplifies. But that's just one. And back to the David Hume stuff. True, you know what I mean? There's a multiplicity of experiences and relationships. But I think that, you know, like when you go to the movies, there's not one movie in the theater. There are 89 movies because there are 89 people in the theater. There's not one black experience. There's 15 million black experiences. Yeah. And of those 15 million black experiences, all of the people that they've met in their lives, all of the experiences, the media that they've had, et cetera, and many of those experiences are not black experiences or white experiences or their experiences. You look at the way people dress in Italy and these days, and you can, you know, find traces of African American experience that has permeated through culture and winds up in Italian fashion design, right?
Yeah.
You know, or you find martial arts experiences that wind up in various aspects of black culture that date to the Shaolin Temple. So recognizing that the idea of purity is illusory, but recognizing that a lot of people have a lot of things in common, and there's an agreement that certain things mean certain things. You know, it's so hard. it's I think it's true of gender too. I mean, we try and make these strict definitions as to male and female, but what's happened is that we're becoming a lot more honest about the varieties of gender and the varieties of how at certain moments there's a more femininity and or more masculinity in our behavior or in our assumptions or in our beliefs. And I think that it's this struggle, this back and forth between wanting to lock things in and having an explanation, and then also and also just recognizing the fact that, that at any given moment anything can happen.
Yeah, it's like what is the contested ground of any of this stuff? It's almost like a lot of it just seems manufactured. We were talking about manufactured rage last time, and you know what you're speaking to is exactly that idea. It's like, what are we on about? What's the tension? You know, where's, you know, Beyonce makes a record. Wow, you know, how is that a? You know, I can't believe, you know, we don't play country music. We don't play Beyonce. We're a country music station. Suddenly, it goes on a poster held outside of a building. And the guy was just like, well, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was Beyonce. It was a Beyonce show. You know, so, but for her, that's money in the bank, right? For her team, that's exactly what they're looking for. And so, because thank you, now I can start the dialogue, you know, and move this record into the mainstream. And you know, Mr. Plummer and Mickey Guyton go, hey, look at us, and we're in the back, you know, doing this for 15 years.
You know what's funny is what I'm getting out of this is that, and this is not a judgment, this is just an observation. Beyonce and Trump are doing the same thing. That what they're doing is they're marketing superficiality. And she may be doing it tongue in cheek, and hopefully people can see through it. And he's doing it too because he's not an idiot, you know.
No.
I think that the biggest mistake pop culture makes, or news talking heads make, is thinking that Trump is stupid. Now, he's as clever and as cunning as anybody who's ever been in American politics. He's just taking advantage of the innate human desire to be a part of a group.
Yeah, I've said for a while. I think one of the problems with the Democrats in the Trump era is that they don't have events for people to go to. People like to get, especially Trump's people, they love to get the lawn chairs and the t-shirts. Look at them. It's the biggest thing that's going to happen to them in their retirement years.
Right,
for sure. This is way bigger than the golf tournament, way bigger than the party at Bob's birthday party down at the club. This is, I'm going to go see Trump. I'm going to be part of history. And, I mean, he got people to walk into Capitol and knock over planets.
The only thing he didn't do is he didn't, market T-shirts at the riot.
That what?
He didn't. I'm surprised he didn't.
Yeah, he could have made a lot of money off of that. I was at the riot, and all I got was this stupid T-shirt.
Or maybe selling gas masks. You know,
next time go in with a Trump 6950. But yeah, I agree. We're in a world of promotion and hype, and it's almost like reaching its apex, it seems like. And I, you know, always think of Mike Judge and his Mike Judge's Beavis and Butthead and Idiocracy. I mean, you think of Idiocracy and you're real, you know, you just kind of see it happening around.
Yeah.
This And so what I guess what I'm hoping we're doing is, well, kind of what we're doing now, which is wandering around and trying to figure out what it is we're doing, at the same time as understanding that there is import in understanding the black-white genetics of this country.
Yeah.
In a real, sincere way where we have that full understanding instead of what seems to be what you're talking about, where Judge Roberts goes, yeah, I think we're done here. We've done what we can for the black people or whatever. And it's like, no, that's not what that means. You know, misunderstanding the whole point. It's a human endeavor. It's human endeavor. We're trying to improve the human endeavor.
You know, I think that is really interesting what you just said, because it's a different attitude, and this applies to my understanding of things in my own personal life. I've been struggling with this. It's that life isn't a checklist. It isn't like you do this, you do this. Life is a way of living. It's developing an attitude that recognizes that over time you have to have an open mind and an open heart. And the attitude that Roberts has is that there is a finite way in which you can measure and come to a post-racial world. Well, there isn't a post-racial world because the races still exist. How can there be a post-racial world unless everyone were literally breeding each other out of the races out of existence? And that hasn't happened yet. We're going on 43 minutes, but I've got one other question. I've noticed on my wasting time YouTube explorations that there's a site that shows the demographic changes of various countries and cities and the fact that America has radically changed demographically, and the fact that we're close to a 50-50 white non-white country, whether or not that subtext is frightening and creating a the great replacement theory, whether or not Roberts or country music programmers or other folks are on a very basic emotional level scared that because of the sins of the father or whatever, that there will be a retribution visited upon them once the balance is shifted, and that it's an us and them rather than the fact that people of color have enormous cultural influences because the American history that was generated by people who are not people of color, and similarly, white people have a tremendous cultural identity and nexus. Being American to a great extent being influenced by the non-white Americans who preceded this current generation, and whether or not how do you feel? Do you, on some basic level, feel threatened by the demographic shift?
No, I don't. So I don't. I think the future is whatever that's going to be racially when we're talking about that. It's like a couple of things. So this morning I went out to go get coffee, and the place didn't open when I expected it to. But I stood on the sidewalk at 8 a.m. and all these workers came. They're working on this big building right across the street from where I am.
You're in Los Angeles right now.
And all these workers, I'm in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills, and these workers came walking past me of all various abilities. And they're all carrying tools. Some have drills, some have crowbars. They all have their lunch buckets and their hard hats, and they're going to work on this big building that's covered in scaffolding. Of 10, there may be 60 walked past me. 10 of the 10 people, if you have 10 of these people, 9 of them are Hispanic and speaking Spanish. 9 of them. There was one black guy. There was maybe 2 or 3 white guys. I couldn't really perfectly tell. You can see an African-American because there he is. But everybody else is Hispanic, and they're almost all of them are speaking Spanish. I heard one conversation in English passing by. They're all chattering and talking. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. They're all going to work, and they work together every day. And they're all in there. It's between 25 and 45. I mean, these are seasoned workers that are, you can tell, they like know what they're doing. They didn't get them home from Home Depot yesterday and put them to work. These are guys that are journeymen, electricians and iron workers and people, you know, who do this business. That's who's building California. You know, this is a different world in that regard. It's a very Hispanic country, becoming more so. I think that's the biggest change that's happening to America. And that if Texans are fighting against that, that may be part of what they do. They like to play it as a panoply of races coming across, and the darker, the scarier, right? And so we all know that's kind of foolish. We all know. I mean, I agree with you that that's part of it. I've been spending a lot of time in colonial Louisiana and this research around this project that I'm working on. So I'm spending a lot of time studying colonialism, the French colonial exercise that was happening in the Gulf Coast and in that area at that time. And it's pretty fascinating. I don't know much about it, and now I know more and more. I think, to answer your question, I think what may be happening is there may be a fear of being colonized, because we colonized. The white people came here and colonized. And to understand what colonization means, I think would be a big help in understanding what the fears are. Because when Europeans colonized the Americas, it was done in this sort of weird way of saying, well, I planted a flag here next to your village, and you are now the subject of a king, of the King of France. And to the natives on the ground, just like if someone came to your front yard and said, I have now claimed your house for Tajikistan, you'd laugh. You'd say, well, you got 10 minutes to get off my lawn. You know, they'd say, no, you are now subject to being absurd, right? So I think there was a sense of absurdity in that, but it became inexorable over time, over decades and decades and decades. It took a really long time for that to happen. We like to think of it all happening kind of a blink of the eye. But in fact, it happened over a couple of centuries and even continues to this day. So it could be that what we're seeing is some kind of, I don't know, genetic reaction to the idea of being colonized, because, you know, certainly Jefferson et al. Feared black uprisings, especially after the Haitian Revolution of 1791. They all were scared shitless that blacks who there were 50,000 white people and 450,000 black people in Virginia in 1740 or whatever. We know, I mean, there were many more black people than white people in Virginia, and the population only evened out and maybe got more whites than blacks after the Civil War. You know what I mean? So in these agricultural worlds. So, I think the great replacement theory is something promulgated by some philosopher or some writer at some point. And it becomes then, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, that we have these cultural things that we grasp onto as a hope of helping to understand our moment. But our moment is really a continuum. So maybe what there's a perception of people in the moment, of a continuous overtaking that's inexorable, and How do you stop it? And like you said, maybe Chief Roberts goes, okay, well, we just start closing doors. You know, we just start closing doors and hope they don't figure out how to come in through the transom. Because they're coming. It's happening, right? When you study history, one of the things it gives you is a 30,000-foot view of life, because that's
Yeah.
the only way you can study the Middle Ages is 1,000 fucking years, you know?
Yeah.
Crazy stuff happened. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, this. Well, no, it took centuries. And this will take centuries. And it's not what I always tell the kids is you should learn Spanish, because Hispanic people like to speak Spanish. We're becoming a bilingual society. And if you don't speak both languages, or at least speak more than one language, you're just not quite as included in the moment as you might otherwise have been. So try to hold on to, you know, your racial identity in this society, in an American society, to me is, I don't know. Yeah.
But
I'm saddened by people, guys.
It's hard not to, because it makes it so much easier to market to you.
What?
It's hard not to be continually racialized, because it makes marketing easier. It makes creating conflicts and controversies that excite and stimulate activity and passions and engagement easier. It's just a tried and true method
Yeah. It's
to
almost like what we want to do is make sure that African Americans are seen as complete Americans before it all changes again. Whatever becomes in America, you know, gets totally Hispanicized, which is really kind of what's happening. And that itself is an interesting take, especially when you consider.
Well, we've done, we've done a pretty good show here. I think we probably ought to wrap it up.
Yeah.
But
Again, I.
you pointed to another potential program. I know, particularly in the South, a lot of African Americans who are particularly opposed to more immigration from Mexico and from Latin America, and who see that group as a competitive underclass, and the way in which blacks will be remarginalized. And that might be an interesting topic for us, and particularly if we have interview somebody from a Latin American or Mexican American perspective who might share with us their take on all this as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for sure. That's a huge part of where we are. So I think what we're doing is rambling through the brambles with Clark Taylor.
And Hobart Taylor.
And next time, we'll continue the search for whatever it is we're searching for. Maybe
bring a
it's a
flashlight.
MacGuffin. Maybe it's a MacGuffin. Maybe the racial championship we hope is just the thing you never get. The thing in the movies you constantly hope for, but you never actually get. I don't know. All right, buddy.
Be well.
You too.